Next up, we have Tom Squiss and Jessica Pressman. How are you?
Pretty so, Squiss.
Jessica Pressman, by the way, has been sort of doing an incredible job of maintaining the Electronic Literature Organization, sometimes Lonely Birth at UCLA, and has really helped us through some great great and difficult times at times, and has done a fabulous job, and has also done something that I really admire, having been the executive director of the ELO while I was trying to finish my dissertation, and not doing exceedingly well while I was executive director of the ELO. She's also made great progress as a scholar of electronic literature, and I think we'll be seeing a little bit of that. And she's accompanied by Tom Squiss, who I guess is sort of her flunky for the evening. Tom Squiss is a poet who teaches at the University of Iowa. He is now focused on teaching new media literature. He shares an appointment with the university's project on the rhetoric of inquiry and is editor of the Iowa Review Web. He also, I just found out, writes about rock autobiographies on the side, so he's flying from here to Seattle to give a presentation at the Jimi Hendrix Experience Museum. So he has quite an illustrious career. But the Iowa Review Web, which I think you're showing some work from, many of us were very happy and relieved to see over the last few years the Iowa Review, which has really been one of the sort of bastions of literary journals for, 40 years in print, really has embraced new media, and I've seen that as sort of one of the signs that literary culture as a whole is opening up to the peculiar, I've heard the word arcane, art form that we're working in now, and a lot of that in the last couple of years has been due to Tom's effort. So a little bit from the Iowa Review. What?
Jessica, you need to chair. We're going to show a few pieces from the Iowa Review. Just talk very briefly about it. The idea here was to make a connection. Marjorie, when she invited us to do this presentation, was to try to make a connection back to some of the morning activities or afternoon activities. And so this isn't a straight presentation as in a reading, but a little bit of explication as well as showing some work at the same time. I like to connect what we're about to show back into a couple of sort of key phrases that or key words that came up this morning. One would be documentation, which is a word that came from Howard. And because clearly, one of the things we're trying to do at the Iowa Review Web is to document other aspects of electronic literature besides the object itself, besides the literary object itself, and I'll talk about that in a second. And a key word, another word would be obviously Joe's, because he runs the Electronic Book Review. We are, of course, as a journal involved in the dissemination of electronic literature, but a word I want to add to this mix, which hasn't yet come up today, would be the word pedagogy. And it seems to me that from the time I took over the Iowa Review Web, one of the things we had an interest in was sort of developing a sort of space in which electronic literature could be both in conversation with other kinds of literatures and to do a sort of teaching or pedagogical activity so that the reader coming there would not only experience the electronic literature piece, the object itself, but also have some language or some discourse or some rhetoric surrounding it to help them understand it, to help them locate it, to help them place it, to help them historicize. All those things that we need for the most part as readers, but sometimes don't get enough of. Now, obviously, in museums, we get some of that because we get the piece and we get a little sign and sometimes we get some language about it. But the Iowa Review, when it first started, and a number of journals still, were more like, and if we can go to the archive site, Jessica, were more like what the Iowa Review started as in 1999, which makes us an old school journal, because that's a long time ago for this particular kind of work. If you click in there, and if you go all the way to the bottom, you can see that for the first year and a half, these were issues, but they were also just single objects. In other words, when the I Review came out, it would only publish a piece, and then a month or two would go by, it would publish another piece. Another thing I just wanted to notice, which is a sort of unusual but terrific feature of the Review in this particular audience, is that Robert Kendall, who is there, is also here, and M.B. Coverley, of course, is Marjorie over there, and if we scroll up a little bit more, we're going to see, who else do we have here, who's here today? Talon's not here. Hey, I'm here. there are other people that we're going to look at in the archives that are represented here. So this particular group, before I knew it was a group, I guess before it was a group, was always instrumental as colleagues who were interested in electronic literature who were connected already to the I Review. The I Review used to just be single pieces, and if we go back to the homepage now, Jessica, what it's become under my editorship under the last couple of years, though, is more to do, as I said, with trying to create spaces in which both the object itself is exent, but also some discourse about it and also an interview. So here we go back to Howard's point that, you know, in many ways, if these objects disappeared, and we hope they don't, and hence the project for PAD, but if the objects disappeared, we would still have at least some evidence that these pieces had existed, that the writers had given voice to what they had sort of seen about their own work, and that critics had looked at the work. So we would have a way to sort of recreate the work without its visual sense, but we could recreate the sort of interpretive work that had been done at an early stage about the particular work. In this particular case, we can go to Talon, Jessica. And this is a piece by Talon Mehmet. And this is a piece by Talon at the bottom, which we could just click on for a second, and you'll see this piece come up, Self-Portrait as Others. And we'll just let it cycle through there a bit. If you hit the skip preload, Jess, I think we can get right into it. And it's an interesting piece. It's on the border of criticism as well as literature, because what it does is it reappropriates images, famous images from artists, and fools with them, and then takes a sort of random text about other artists and inserts it as the biography of the artist. So you have these sort of odd things where you have Monet, who is heavily influenced by Caravaggio, whose dedication to draftsmanship and you can read it. But you can see it gets wacky pretty soon. And this is sort of the whole, this is sort of the notion that Talon wanted to sort of reinvent himself within the context of both the objects and, or I'm sorry, the paintings themselves, but also involve themselves in sort of, reappropriating, fucking up, basically, the discourse of art criticism, as he does in these particular pieces. We can go back from there, Jessica, if you can go back to the page we were at. And that's a piece by Talon, but as telling as the piece, because the piece just sort of happens to you, I think, is the interview that Marjorie did with Talon. And, or not as telling, but as complex, as interesting, as complicated, and usefully pedagogically, is this long interview that Marjorie did with Talon. And we'll just scroll through. I'm just sort of pointing out some things to you tonight. But it's a long, involved piece where Talon really tries to think through many of the issues that Marjorie raised with him. Let's go back to the home page again, if we could, from there. And we'll look at the left. This is a piece, new work by Joe Tavi, who's here, of course. And this is both a review of Joe's book, by a graduate student of mine, actually, at Iowa. It's also an interview with Joe called Writing Under Constraint, and it's also a new piece by Joe called Overwriting. We're going to look at that just briefly. And one comment I'd make about these critical pieces that we're running, many of them are built in new media style. That is, they're just not straight critical pieces. They couldn't be reproduced in a magazine exactly as they are. And a question I'd sort of have actually for ELO to consider, and I will need to consider this myself as a member of ELO, is how do we locate these critical new media essays about literature? And I'm not sure that's been discussed. Maybe it has. I haven't been part of those discussions, right? ELO is thinking about, well, how do we archive and disseminate the literature? But what do we do about these sort of adjacent pieces? There would be new media essays about the literature. Because surely we need to find a place for them too, because nobody else is going to archive them if we don't. So that's just a thought. I mean, this is a long, interesting essay by Joe. It takes, obviously you can tell by the way it's set up with the images built in, that it's an experimental piece. It's not a traditional piece, and it's not only just because of the images, but it's because other sort of markers that denote it to be a non-scholarly traditional sort of article. And Jess, if we could go back to the homepage from there. And we'll look at a couple of other pieces here just to give you a sense of again, what we're trying to do. This is a piece by the Judd Morrissey Laurie Talley piece. And this would be a piece by Talley and Morrissey. One's an artist, one's a writer. And Jessica, our Jessica here, both did an essay about the piece, a very interesting piece, published by Eastgate called My Name is Captain, Captain. And also did an interview with Judd Morrissey and Laurie Talley. Want to go to that piece, maybe, Jessica? And then this is Jessica talking with them. And again, as in many of the interviews, because we try to choose people who are deeply interested in the work that they look at, it goes in a lot of unexpected and interesting places. And it really does dig up, unearth, locate a language, a discourse for us to really begin to know how to place the piece, as opposed to just experiencing and going, oh, I like that, or oh, I didn't. And of course, I think we all agree that if ELO is to be successful and if electronic literature is going to grow, thrive, get taught, all those sort of institutional things that have to happen to it, it's going to be because there's a fair amount of critical language out there available to us at the same time so that we can teach it ourselves and also teach our students about it. We'll play that little piece you could if my captain. Captain, I'm not sure if we're plugged in there or not.
This
So this is just a little excerpt, not visually oriented, but the auditory end of this. And then I think we're going to go just back to the archive, Jess, and we'll stop right there. And again, this is just to give you a history of sort of how the work has progressed or how the magazine has progressed in relationship to the very important work of both archiving, disseminating, and thinking about electronic literature. And we'll go back, let's go to, 2002. And these are also, what we've tried to do along the way too, we've tried to mix what have been thought of as artist pieces with literary pieces. In other words, some of these people don't even think of themselves as writers so much as artists. And I just had a great conversation earlier around the cocktail table there with a couple of artists, Ann Burdick and others, who were thinking about conceptual art in relationship to digital literature and how perhaps we increasingly need to expand our notion of what constitutes the literary. I know that as a poet, I've had to think of my own work less in terms of poetry and more in terms of poetics, and probably we need to think too in terms of literature broadly construed. If there's language on what is constituted an art site, is it also possible literature? Those are issues that, you know, need a lot of attention, I think. We're trying to do some of it in the iReview web, but it's an ongoing project. I'll just end with a couple tiny little pieces. They're very light, very slight, but they're exactly the kind of pieces that I'd like ELO to be able to locate. I think ELO is going to have an easy time finding the big, important projects. If you're looking for a Talon Mehmet piece, or if you're looking for a Marjorie piece, we know where to get them, and we'll probably go locate them. I think it's going to be more difficult to find these sort of ephemeral little pieces that do wonderful little strange work. And I'll end with a couple of pieces here. This is by a poet who lives in Buenos Aires, very influenced by concrete poetry, which never really hit big here in the States, though there was movements of it and Fluxus was connected to it in the 60s and 70s. But the Brazilian and Argentinian and South American version of concrete poetry is still very much alive and very important. She started in that generation of poets, but now has moved her work to digital. And I think these are just lovely, light, funny, interesting pieces, but wouldn't want them to get lost. But they're the kind of pieces that you have to search for to sort of keep in your lens. So we'll look at a couple. The first one's called The Grand Parade.
Oh,
concrete poem. It's the March of Letters with a little band. Let's go back from there. And the next one's called Skirmish in English. We have two A's. You know, I mean, she's very interested in the materiality of language, obviously, the way the concrete poets were. And let's go look at one more just really quick. And we'll look at balance. So there's lovely, playful little visual objects that do what they're advertised to do in sort of letter form. And we'll stop there. Thanks.